Good morning and welcome to Revel's first Yom Iyun on the uptown campus of Yeshiva University. I'm very privileged, as was announced, to serve as the Associate Dean of the Bernard Revel Graduate School, as I think many of you know. Earlier this morning, studies were launched by our dean, David Berger, who, when I was studying in Revel 25 years ago, was one of the beloved professors of the school, of the graduate school, but he was a visiting professor. This was not his mainstay, even though he had gone through college here and gone through Smicha. He was full-time at Brooklyn College. Nonetheless, he had a very, very strong following among the students, and he was very, very, very well liked. And in 1991, as some of you may remember, some of you are too young to remember this, but I remember it very well, because in 1991 I was studying for my PhD in the Bernard Revel Graduate School, and an announcement was made that the Bernard Revel Graduate School would be closed because of a lack of funds. And you can imagine what that did to my aspirations as a PhD student at the time. Needless to say, or it should not have to be said, I think in this environment, I think given the current administration, that would not be something that would even be on the table for discussion. But at that time, perhaps, it wasn't clear to some people how important it was for Yeshiva University to house the Bernard Revel Graduate School. I think perhaps the fact that Dr. Berger and other very important Jewish scholars were not full-time at Yeshiva University maybe made a statement in and of itself. Dr. Berger was on panel along with other professors also who were teaching at Revel part-time, but who were committed to Jewish scholarship, academic Jewish scholarship within a Torah environment, and they formed a committee to revive the graduate school. I think it says a great deal about President Joel's administration that over the last few years, he's brought a number of such scholars, such as David Berger, to be full-time at Yeshiva University. The dean of Yeshiva College currently is Dr. Eichler, who similarly used to come every week from Pennsylvania, where he taught full-time at the University of Pennsylvania. And in recent years, he was brought here to teach at YU in Bernard Revel. I'm a little bit disappointed that he was tapped to be the dean of Yeshiva College. That takes him away from us a little bit, but certainly it's for the greater good, and I'm sure he's doing great things for Yeshiva College. But can't wait to get him back full-time with us as well. And it's not just those two individuals, but you'll see on your spread around distributed, there is a new brochure of the graduate school. Have a look at it. It just came out. It's hot off the press. And you'll actually see a very nice picture of Professor Kaplan on the cover. And you see the listing of our faculty, which is over 20. When I started teaching in the Bernard Revel Graduate School in the mid-90s, the number of full-time or core faculty, I think, was about 3 or 4. And it really grew exponentially under the administration of President Joel, and we are indebted to him for that. Now, I guess I should say a few words before I actually start talking about the Rambam, to distinguish myself from Dr. Berger, who's not only a bigger Talmud Chacham than I am and a greater scholar than I am, he's also a lot more principled and humble than I am. And when he began his talk, and the purpose of our gathering today, at least from a Revel perspective, is to promote the idea of academic Jewish scholarship within the Torah environment and how it contributes to orthodoxy. So Dr. Berger started by saying that, well, you shouldn't take what he says, or you have to take it with a grain of salt, because it's self-interest to promote Jewish scholarship. He's also very humble because, for those of you who are at his lecture, I think most of you, he referred to some sources in the Ramban. He neglected to say that he has written substantial studies on the complexity of the Ramban's view and on a number of other issues that he discussed, really, that are defining studies in this area. I am not as humble, nor as principled, although I won't go through my studies. It's many fewer than Dr. Berger's, but I'll talk about the principle right now. He said he's no Geba Davar, so it's not for him to really promote the graduate school, to do an advertisement. I'm not as principled, so I will do an advertisement. And I think the reasoning for it is, well, maybe I have some principles, and that is that I think that it's up to the administration of the Revel Graduate School to explain what we're doing. No one is here. You're not forced to be here. If you don't want to listen to it, and if you want to discount it, you can. But what we're trying to do is, in this morning of learning, give people a taste of Jewish scholarship, a sense of what Jewish scholarship has to offer. And by all means, we are interested in attracting additional students. And it's not only younger people. I see a number of my students in the audience. And some of my students, actually, I told to go to the other lecture because you've already heard my stuff in the classes, but we also are open to auditors as well. And a number of people retire and start Revel degrees. Some people are working, start Revel degrees. We have classes in the evening. And that's what this brochure is all about. So you get a little bit of a sense of it, and you do have the website to see more information. Let me also draw your attention, and I think this is our last station identification, to this yellow sheet, which announces another lecture that we will be having on Tuesday evening, May 4th, at 8 p.m. It will be by Meira Poliak, Professor Meira Poliak, who is the head of the Bible Department at Tel Aviv University, who is one of the world's foremost scholars of Karaite Bible exegesis. And she does a lot of very exciting work, medieval commentaries that many of our Rishonim, even in the rabbinite tradition, used, such as Ibn Ezra, for example, and I think even the Rambam, whom I'll speak about, used Karaite commentators. Many of them were lost or were not published because they were written in Arabic. They were in manuscripts. In the early 1900s, scholars spoke about manuscripts in St. Petersburg. And now they're not available to us, or I shouldn't say now, excuse me, until about 20 years ago they were not available to us. Now, with the fall of the Soviet Union and the opening up of the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union, we now have access to those manuscripts. Meira Poliak is part of an institute at Tel Aviv University and other universities in Israel which are publishing these commentaries, and this is a very exciting endeavor. Invite you all to join us for a public lecture by Professor Poliak on May 4th. As a way of introduction to this lecture, and taking my cue from Dr. Berger's introduction, the idea of academic Jewish studies and why it is essential, and I would even use that strong word, it's absolutely essential for a complete understanding of Torah, what we consider as Torah knowledge. I think in the case of Parshanut HaMikra, in the case of Bible interpretation, understanding of Tanakh, it is something that is absolutely self-evident. And if it's not self-evident, well, so I meet frequently with Dr. Berger, and I often tell him if it's not self-evident outside of Revel, then it's our fault. We have to do a better job of getting the word out. But that's what this shiur is all about. To understand our tradition of Parshanut HaMikra, to understand who were the Mefarshim, what was their mindset, what made them tick, where were they coming from, you really have to go beyond the traditional curriculum of the yeshiva world, which might include the Mikraos Gedolos, despite the fact that Dr. Berger said that that person he met at the Bris refused to lean over to give him the Ramban, but at least they know about the Ramban. It's basically you have Chumash, you have Rashi. Sometimes people look at Ibn Ezra, sometimes people look at the Ramban, but that's the standard Mikraos Gedolos. But people tend to think, and I know this from my own experience, who is Rashi? Rashi is words on a page. Who is the Ramban? Words on a page. And you don't get a sense of Rashi as a real person. And I like to tell my students a story. We all know that when a bar mitzvah boy says his drasha or gives his speech after his laning, the rabbi gives him a mikros gedolos. And so that's the common minhag in America. I don't know if they had that minhag in Rashi's time, but some of us imagine that Rashi also got his chumash, and it just had a space missing for Rashi, and he had to fill that in. But Rashi was a real person. Rashi's not just words on a page. Rashi grew up in France in the 11th century. What was going on in France in the 11th century? How did that influence his thinking? What were the issues on the agenda of the day for the Jewish community? What was he looking for in his interpretation of Tanakh? And you won't really understand or appreciate Rashi's commentary unless you see that. As I mentioned, Meira Poliak is doing Karaite works. Karaites lived, the Karaites she deals with lived in the 10th century in Jerusalem. And they were people who were very devout, who were expecting the Messiah at any moment. And that was an issue of concern for them. Ibn Ezra lived in Spain and then traveled throughout Europe throughout his lifetime. And he often used Karaite commentaries, but then tried to define how he was different from the Karaites and to try to define a Rabbinite ideology. This was not a concern for Rashi. Rashi didn't know about the Karaites. It wasn't important for him. Rashi had his discussions and disputations with Christians, and you have to understand that to appreciate his commentary. Now, it's not only the Mikros Gedolos and the individual authors in the Mikros Gedolos that we understand better. It's also the very parameters of Parshanut HaMikra. What is the definition of interpretation of Tanakh? And here is where the figure I'd like to discuss today comes into play, and that's the Rambam, Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon, whose dates are 1138 to 1204, and he was born in Muslim Spain, and he traveled to North Africa, and then lived most of his adult life in Egypt, and he lived entirely in a Muslim environment. Rashi never once quotes Rashi. Never refers to Rashi by name. It is astounding because it's hard to imagine that he did not know who Rashi was. He was born 30 years after Rashi's death, and yet he never quotes Rashi once. And that, I think, says something about his cultural allegiance, which was to the sages in Muslim Spain, perhaps the sages also in the East, such as Rav Sadia Gaon, but he does not mention Rashi. He makes a mention of Rabbeinu Yaakov, which may be Rashi's grandson, Rabbeinu Tam, but he doesn't speak very much of him. He mentions the Ravid, who was one of his critics, as a great sage, and that's Provence. So it's important to see who is the constellation of Mefarshim that the Rambam knew about. Now, when I talk about the Rambam in terms of Bible interpretation, in terms of the interpretation of Tanakh, people sometimes are a little perplexed. They sometimes will say to me, that question Dr. Berger mentioned, people will ask me, what are you working on? And so I say, I'm working on the Rambam's interpretation. I've been working on that for about 10 years now. My book, with God's help, will come out a year from now. It will be published by Brill Academic Press. And people listen to that and they're confused because they don't know about the Rambam's commentary. So the first thing they say to me is, oh, you mean the Ramban? And I say, no, I thought about it a little bit. I didn't get it mixed up between the Rambam and Ramban. It really is the Rambam. So they say, oh, I didn't know he wrote a Perush. And that's where I can launch into a 45-minute lecture, which is what I'm doing here. I was invited to do that. The Rambam wrote works that ostensibly are not commentaries on the Bible. He wrote Mishneh Torah, he wrote Sefer HaMitzvot, he wrote Moreh Nevuchim. People think of Mishneh Torah correctly as a work of halakha, and Moreh Nevuchim perhaps less correctly as a work of philosophy, which is something we will discuss in a moment. But it became very clear to me that the Rambam is a central piece in a chain of tradition, and often if you don't see his critical role in terms of theory of interpreting Tanakh and practice of interpreting Tanakh, you don't really understand the tradition of our interpretation, our tradition of Parshanut HaMikra. And a last word, I promise, of introduction. When I speak about the tradition of Parshanut HaMikra, Bible interpretation becomes new every generation because there are new issues. I mentioned Rashi deals with the Christians in his environment. The Rambam dealt with Muslim influences in his environment. Ibn Ezra differentiated himself from the Karaites. You can go to the Malbim, who lived in the 19th century in Eastern Europe, and he had his battles with the Reform and with the Haskalah. And nowadays, in the 20th century, we're actually in the 21st century, I have to remind myself, in the 21st century, there are new issues, and people will sometimes hear scholars of Tanakh speak about issues having to do with Zionism, having to do with the army, having to do with Torah Umada, various issues, and you have new interpretations. And I do have an ideology, and I do have sometimes an axe to grind. One thing that I feel very strongly about, which is why perhaps I went into the field of Parshanut HaMikra, is that while I don't deny the importance of new interpretations, and I think it is important for people to look at Tanakh, in Israel sometimes they say, Naki, just look at the Tanakh without any Mefarshim, see what does it say to me? I think that is valuable. However, I think it's extremely important, and one of the defining moments or defining features of Orthodox study of Tanakh, whether it be academic or yeshiva learning, is defined by an appreciation for our chain of tradition. There's nothing wrong with giving a new interpretation, but you should know what the Rambam said. You should know what the Ramban said. You have to have an appreciation for what came before. And there's one word that sometimes people think of as a dirty word in scholarship. That's what scares people away from scholarship. It's called the footnote. Oh, professor, do I have to do footnotes in my paper? And the answer is the footnote shows a sense of humility. A footnote shows you read what 10 people or 20 people or 30 people before you read when they looked at this very same issue. And you know what? Maybe you are smarter than all of them. Probably not. But even if you are, you will have a lot to gain from things that they said, even if you disagree, even if you have a new insight. And that, to my mind, is what defines Orthodox Bible scholarship. And here, I think, that, you know, judging by the reaction from the audience here, I think that that's precisely what a Torah philosophy would say, if anything. But that is good academic scholarship, looking at the issue, researching what earlier scholars have said about the matter. And that's where I think that the two really go hand in hand. And so I did give out a list of sources here. I won't be reading all of them inside, but this is something for you to take away for future reference. Let me begin by speaking about one dimension of the Rambam's Parshanut. Where do you find the Rambam's Parshanut, his Perushim? Someone actually did a work where he excerpted, cited snippets from various writings of the Rambam and arranged them according to the order of the Parshiot, according to the Psukim, and that is a convenient way of seeing what the Rambam has to say about a particular pasuk, but that's not what I'm going to be speaking about here. I'm going to be speaking about the genres of literature that the Rambam composed. And the first one I'd like to focus on is Moreh Nevuchim, the Guide of the Perplexed, which people typically think of as a work of philosophy. And it does indeed have a philosophical content, and the Rambam does refer to important Greek and Arabic philosophers. However, the Rambam in the first passage that I give you here says, what is the purpose of this composition? He says, Inyano harishon leva'er inyane shemot ba'u b'sifrei hanevu'ah. To explain, and here, this is a translation into Hebrew of the Maimonides' original Arabic. He says the first purpose of this treatise is to explain. The word shemot is a little misleading. In modern Hebrew it means names, but it really means terms, individual words in the Bible. Sometimes you have a word that has multiple meanings, And you have to understand that sometimes a word cannot be taken literally. So, for example, it says, speaks about the hand of God. Maimonides says God does not have a hand. You have to understand that that means the power of God. And the Maimonides applies this in many other cases when it says that God was pleased or God was angry or God was upset. You have to understand that metaphorically. And he does that not only for passages having to do with God. He also says, for example, whenever it says in the Bible that someone saw an angel, Maimonides says you can't see an angel. An angel is defined as pure spirit, has no physical dimensions. So Maimonides says whenever it says in the Bible that someone saw an angel, it means that he had a vision where he imagined that he saw an angel. And he has other such passages where he explains how you are to understand those words. And he goes through dictionary definitions and he says, it's not only in theologically sensitive issues, this is just a feature of language. So for example, it says that Ruach Elohim merachefet al penei hamayim. How do you translate penei hamayim? So does the water have a face? No, it has a surface. So actually you see that's a dead metaphor in English because surface means from French, sewer, and face is the visage, is the face of the water, on the face of the water. So you see, even in English, you have that metaphor. But if you think about it, sometimes Hebrew is a metaphorical language. How do you say the top of the mountain in Hebrew? Rosh Ahar. And if you were translating to English as the head of the mountain, it would be an incorrect translation. It's the top of the mountain. So Maimonides really goes through about 50 chapters of the first section of Moreh Nebuchim explaining terms. How do you understand those individual words gives you a proper dictionary definition. And in doing this, he draws upon earlier Mefarshim that actually I've documented in my book. And it's interesting to ask which Mefarshim did the Rambam use, which were on his bookshelf. And that's a fascinating discussion, but not for this talk in this context. Maimonides goes on and says, "Ubichlal ha-ma'amar hazeh kavana shniya." There is another purpose, and that is "v'hu bi'ur mishalim stumim me'od," to try to explain parables in the Bible. There are passages in Tanakh which are not meant literally, and it's not just individual words, but here a mashal is different from what he spoke about before as shemot. Here we're talking about a whole literary unit. A whole story. An example we'll actually talk about later is the book of Iov. Sefer Iov, the Rambam follows the opinion in the Talmud that Iov lo haya velo nivra ela mashal haya. Iov, Job, the great, pious, righteous person who was afflicted with terrible suffering that deals with the problem of evil, Maimonides says that this is a fiction. It's not a person that actually lived historically because the point of the book is not to deal with this particular person. It's to tell you the philosophy, the Jewish ideology of how to deal with the problem of evil and God's providence. That's an example of a mashal. It's a whole literary unit. And Maimonides has other mishalim that he discusses. Actually, the topic of my first book, it's called Three Approaches to Biblical Metaphor, is really rooted in this very distinction. What's the difference between a metaphor and an allegory? And I explore in my book, it's called Three Approaches to Biblical Metaphor. You can see it on the website. It deals there with Rav Sajigon, it deals with Maimonides, it deals with Ibn Ezra, and it deals with Radak as well. So Maimonides says that the point of his book is to tell you how to explain words and literary units in the Bible. That is the goal of his book. He does not speak about philosophy. He then does say, it's true, that it's not a line-by-line commentary, but rather it deals with issues and methodologies of how you interpret Tanakh. And in this respect, Moreh Nevuchim is in some ways more valuable than a line-by-line commentary because he tells you the philosophy, the ideology of his parshanut. Many of us are familiar with Rashi's famous comment in Breishit Perek Gimel Pasuk Chet, where Rashi says, "Ani lo bati ela lipshuto shel mikra." I'm only going to do pshat. And, seas of ink have been spilled to try to explain. If anyone has looked at Rashi for more than 5 minutes, you know that Rashi mostly gives you Midrash. What was he thinking? What was the ideology? What did he mean by Pshuto Shel Mikra? The problem is, Rashi wrote a line-by-line commentary with no introduction, with no explanation of his principles, of his theory behind it, so you don't know what he was thinking, and you have to gather that empirically from a study of his commentaries. Maimonides tells you the ideology behind his commentary, and in many respects, I'll take the comments and questions at the end, but thank you, I do encourage them. Maimonides draws here upon a tradition. He's not a first. And he was very well aware of the earlier commentators that came before him, such as Rav Sadia Gaon. And Rav Sadia Gaon really was a pioneer. Ibn Ezra refers to Rav Sadia Gaon as Rosh HaMedabrim B'chol Makom, the first speaker on all matters. And Rav Sadia Gaon wrote a philosophical treatise as well, called Emunot V'Deot, where he establishes that when you learn the Bible, when you learn Tanakh, you have to do it within the context of understanding science, understanding philosophy. He also deals with Eov in that book. He also deals with the fact that you cannot take words about God, defining God with a body literally. And Maimonides is picking up on that tradition of Rav Sadia Gaon, that scripture and science must be reconciled with one another. And this is where we get to the second source. Maimonides speaks about Maaseh Breishit. And this is, you know, Maimonides has really selected topics that are particularly exciting to him and particularly interesting to him. He devotes two chapters, for example, to Eov. That's a very important book in his, sort of on his syllabus, in his curriculum. And the other, one of the other very important topics is the creation, the world, the story of creation. How was the world created? And this, of course, is not to a small extent because of his involvement with Aristotelian science. And Maimonides says that one of my first purposes in this book, Hakavana Rishona B'zeh HaMa'amar, Haita Leva'er Ma She'efshar Leva'aro Mimaaseh Breishit, to explain the story of creation. And he says one of the most important things to know about this, and he says this in bold, is he says that not everything there, Eino Kulo Al Pshuto, it is not meant to be taken literally at every point, because this is not a scientific account of creation. And it's in the next passage that he says this even more strongly, and this is a very striking passage that I think is very important for understanding the parameters of Maimonides' understanding of science and how it should be meshed and how it must be sort of brought together with the study of Tanakh. Maimonides here refers to the Aristotelian doctrine of the eternity of the world. Aristotle believed that the rules of physics are eternal, that the world was always the way it is, and it will always remain that way. And Maimonides agrees with Aristotle, he says, for half of his ideology, saying that the world will never change, the rules of nature will never change, and therefore he says, for example, in the passage in Yeshayahu, v'garze evin keves v'namerim gedir batz, that the animals will change their nature and will no longer be ferocious. Maimonides says that is not to be taken literally because it contradicts science, and so therefore Maimonides says that's an allegory, that's an allegory telling you that in the time of the Messiah, that the wealthy will not oppress the poor, or the strong will not oppress the weak. And sometimes I think that's a bigger miracle than the animals changing their nature. But Maimonides has a question about the eternity of the world in terms of creation, because Aristotle believed that the world was not created. Whereas the pasuk in Breishit says, Breishit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim ve'et ha-aretz. It says it black on white that the world was created. So Maimonides here says that the fact that I'm not accepting Aristotle's view is not because it says the opposite in Breishit. Okay? And it's sort of a double negative here. Don't think that the reason that I reject Aristotle's scientific view is because it contradicts a pasuk. Because just contradicting a pasuk doesn't scare me. That's not a problem. He says, and here's the bolded, well, I can read the whole thing. Dak ein brichatenu min ha-ma'amar bekadmut ha-olam mipnei ha-ktuvim asher ba'u ba-Torah biyot ha-olam mechudash. Just because it says something different in the Torah does not stop me. Why not? Ki ein ha-ktuvim ha-morim al-chidush ha-olam yoter min ha-ktuvim ha-morim al-heyot Hashem Geshem. Now here, this is a medieval translation. Geshem doesn't mean rain. Geshem is a translation of the Arabic jism, which means a body. If you insist on taking every word in the Torah literally, you would come out saying that God has a body, God has hands, God has eyes, God has emotions. But you can't take it literally. You have to use reason. And Maimonides goes on, and this is a beautiful line, V'lo sha'arei ha-perush stumim befaneinu. Okay, the gates of interpretation are not closed to us. And I actually gave a lecture at Tel Aviv University in the summer on this phrase. This is a beautiful phrase. It's taken from Arabic, Abwab Atawil, which means the sort of the avenues of innovative thinking are not closed. You're allowed to continually think and to create and to come up with new interpretations. That's okay. That's what our tradition says you're supposed to do. It comes from a Muslim expression. In the Muslim jurisprudence, they speak about insidad bab al-ijtihad, which means that the gate of new thinking has been closed. And this is what the Muslim poskim say in the 11th century. They say, it's a little bit similar, a little bit parallel to the Talmud. They say it's basically that a Rishon is not allowed to argue with the Talmud. I'm translating it for us, but it means that you have to go by precedent now. A religious judge is no longer allowed to come up with a new idea. That's what the theory was in Muslim jurisprudence. You can reinterpret the old sources, but you can't come up with just a new decision by yourself. And Maimonides is turning around that phrase, and he's saying the gates of new interpretation are not closed. In halakha, by the way, Maimonides has to tread more lightly because he also knows that you can't debate with the Talmud, so he has other avenues for innovation in halakha, and that's something I deal with in the book that I hope will be coming out next year that deals with Maimonides' thinking. But here's where Maimonides says, in this arena, in this area, we could have interpreted the gates of interpretation are not closed. Now, in source Dalet, Maimonides gives you his ideology of his underlying impetus for this reinterpretation. And Maimonides says there, this is if taken from, not from Moreh Nevuchim, but from Ma'amar Tchiyat HaMitim. And Ma'amar Tchiyat HaMitim is written like a letter, which is interesting because Maimonides' letters, and we have many of his letters, some of them now are being found in the Geniza, and that's particularly exciting. Scholars are working on those. We actually have Maimonides' own handwritten letters. We have even found Maimonides' handwritten version of the commentary on the Mishnah. We found a first draft of some of his works. And you see his cross outs and how he changed them. And this is a whole field of scholarship that is fascinating. And so, well, I don't have to go back to my initial comments. This, I think, for anyone who has any sensitivity as a Torah Jew, it's obvious how beautiful this is to go back to the Rambam. This gives you an insight into his personality. Where did he change his mind? Where did he come up with new ideas? This is what academic Jewish studies, at its best, is all about. And this is what we're doing here at YU. There's a lot of it being done in Israel currently, and that's very exciting. Many exciting developments at the conference I just mentioned in Tel Aviv University. Someone really did speak about some of the Rambam's own handwritten comments. But to get back to our subject, Maimonides wrote Ma'amar Tchiyat HaMitim because he was criticized for interpreting certain passages allegorically or non-literally. And Maimonides writes there, he has two ways of defending this position. One is from tradition, which is what I mentioned before. Maimonides says, I'm not the first one to do this, to reinterpret the psukim, and he speaks about he was criticized there in particular for reinterpreting the passage of Vigar Ze'evim Keves, that the passage that the lamb will dwell with the wolf. He was criticized for reinterpreting that. It says black on white that that it's going to happen. And Maimonides, where does he come off saying that that it's allegorical? So Maimonides says, I'm not the first one to say this. He said, all of the great Mefarshim in Spain say this. And he gives two names, Rabbi Moshe HaKohen ibn Jikatila and Rabbi Yehuda ibn Balaam. And for most of the people, I'm looking at a little bit of blank stares here. For those people who are in my classes, you know, they learned about this the first day, that the Rambam's constellation of commentators is a little bit different than ours. Those were the great Mefarshim in Spain. Excitingly, once again, those commentaries were written in Judeo-Arabic, and they were in manuscript for centuries, and were in the Soviet Union. Now, scholars in Israel and scholars actually in the United States are working on publishing those commentaries that the Rambam used, that Ibn Ezra used. Ibn Ezra quotes those Mefarshim frequently, and they are very important Mefarshim. The Rambam says, first of all, both of them gave that interpretation as well. But then, more importantly, the Rambam gives you the ideology behind it. And he says that most people who are uneducated would like to make the Torah and reason, what he calls it, shtei ktzavot sotrot, to make it two opposite ends. Anything in the Torah, the more fantastic and the more unnatural and the more weird it is, the more spiritual it is, the more exciting it is. And the Rambam says that he's going to do the opposite. And that's Dalit. I'll read it to you because the language is so beautiful. He says, Hamon Anshei HaTorah, and by that phrase, he uses the word in Arabic is Jumhur, which means sort of the masses, who are certainly in his time were uneducated. I think the balance has changed a lot now because of Jewish education, or general education even. Don't forget, in those days, most people didn't have any scientific knowledge. They didn't take biology. So they thought if you get sick, it's because an evil demon came inside of you. We know that, you know, we think differently now. So, you know, I think you have to look at this a little bit differently now. But you understand what the Rambam certainly is dealing with. Hamon anshei haTorah ha'ne'ahav shebedvarim lahem ve'ha'arev l'sichlutam shiyasimu haTorah v'haseichel shnei ktzavot sotrim. To make Torah and reason two contradictory things. And he says, but we, v'anachnu nishtadel lekabetz bein haTorah v'hamuskal. We always try to understand the Torah through the prism of reason. And this is something that is not the Rambam's innovation. It goes back to Aristotle. One of my favorite examples of how the Rambam illustrates this is he quotes a Ma'amar Chazal that says that when a woman is pregnant, that there's an angel inside the womb that tells the fetus to grow. And he says, you know, when I talk to people about this, you know, if I would describe this angel, how do you describe this angel inside of the womb? So you could say that he's a little man with a long white beard, and fiery eyes, and a wand. He said, people love that. They get really excited. Oh, yeah, tell me, you know, does he have a mustache? What kind of beard is it? You know. And the Rambam says, I'm a doctor. I know what the angel is. It's an enzyme that God created that brings the fetus to life. That's what the rabbis meant when they said an angel. And the Rambam, that's an example. Nishtadel lekabetz bein haTorah v'hamuskal. And this is really what he does throughout Moreh Nevuchim. I'd like now to turn to the next source, which refers to the book of Job, which is the one book that the Rambam explains in its entirety in two chapters in Moreh Nevuchim, and it's true that it's a kind of summary of the book, but I myself have spent a good deal of time on this subject because I believe that the Rambam's commentary in those two chapters is a kind of missing link. I published a number of studies showing how the Rambam bases himself or expands upon Rav Sadia Gaon's commentary and Ibn Ezra's commentary, and his commentary in turn became a basis for Ramban. And Ramban wrote a polemic, a commentary that is sort of polemical against the Rambam, but if he didn't have the Rambam, he wouldn't have written his commentary. And so you have different approaches to the problem of evil. And Maimonides says that this is an example of a mashal. And he says, even though it's a mashal, and here I think he has a phrase by Aristotle in the back of his mind, Aristotle said that poetry is more real than history. Because history deals with one specific case, poetry deals with general realities, and this is precisely what Maimonides says when he introduces, and he says that it's a mashal. He said, Eov himself, a guy named Mr. Eov, did not exist, but that kind of reality exists in every generation. It perplexes people, and people have discussed and tried to deal with this problem of evil. And in this passage, Maimonides says that the point of the book of Eov is to outline those views, those philosophies. And if you know the book of Job, we're told that Job suffers and he loses his wealth and he loses his possessions, loses his children, he loses his health. And three friends come to discuss with him, and then a fourth interlocutor comes to discuss why this happened. And they each portray a view. And Maimonides, in his summary, outlines what is the philosophy of each one of these interlocutors. And here's where, to understand the Rambam as a Parshan, is absolutely necessary for understanding the whole concept of Parshanut, of interpreting Tanakh. Because when I looked at the Rambam, and then I went back to Rashi and Rashbam, and interestingly, Rabbeinu Tam also wrote a commentary on Eov. And it's fascinating because you wonder, Rabbeinu Tam didn't write other commentaries. Rabbeinu Tam, the sense I get of his personality was that he was very brilliant and he wanted to take on a challenge. If you're going to write one commentary on one book that's challenging, it's going to be Eov. And he gives an explanation of the words, and so does Rashbam and so does Rashi. But there was a review of these three commentaries by Professor Moshe Sokolow, who teaches here in the Azrieli Graduate School, who's also a Bible scholar in his own right. He wrote a review of these three commentaries, and he says, when I'm finished with those commentaries, I know what every word means in Job, but I don't know what's the point of the book, because what's the philosophy that emerges from it? Rashi was not equipped to deal with the philosophy, subsequently I wrote a study where I tried to make the argument that Rashi has a psychological understanding of the book. That it's without philosophy, Rashi tries to find some meaning in the book, and I take a few passages where I try to show that and present that as an alternative to the Rambam's philosophical view. But you don't really even look for that until you're aware of the issue of how you extrapolate a philosophy from the book. And this is what Maimonides does here. And here he utilizes the Greek and Arabic philosophy that he was aware of. And you look at the bottom of that paragraph, he says the opinion of Eov on this matter resembles the opinion of Aristotle. And the opinion of Eliphaz seems like a simple reading of the Torah. And the opinion of Bildad is the opinion of the Mutazila, which is one of the Muslim schools of philosophy. And the opinion of Tzofar follows the Asharite view, also a Muslim philosophy. And all of those are incorrect. Now, sometimes people wonder, how could the Rambam say that the opinion of the Torah is incorrect? That's something I did a study about. If you're interested, I can direct you to that as well. And then Maimonides goes on and gives you what he regards as the correct philosophy that he gathered from the Torah and the words of the rabbis. Now, that was an example. I'm not going into much greater detail about that. The last subject I'd like to discuss, which is on the second side of the handout, is something I will discuss just very briefly at this point, but I think it's a very exciting area. It's something I've been working on for the last few years, and it is really a central issue in my forthcoming book. This relates to the Rambam as a Parshan in Halakha. And here, once again, many other Mefarshim deal with issues of Halakha in their Perushim, but rarely do we get a crystal clear statement of their theory of Parshanut. How do you interpret the Torah, the text of the Torah, from a legal, a halachic standpoint? keeping in mind that the Talmud often does not take the Bible literally according to Pshuto Shel Mikra. And so this is an issue that Maimonides dealt with at great length. And here there is a little bit of a polemic in my book, because the sort of traditional view of the Rambam is that he had nothing to do with the Pshat revolution of Rashi, of Ibn Ezra, of Rashbam, and that he was sort of isolated. He was reading the Bible as a Talmudist and as a philosopher, and I tried to show that that is incorrect. And in source Vav, Maimonides sets down a principle that is very striking, and it was controversial in its time and has been controversial since, but it's important to know about this. And this is where Maimonides says that he wants to differentiate between laws that are d'oraita and laws that are d'rabbanan. What laws are of biblical force and what laws are of rabbinic source, force. And he says that the only things that are d'oraita are the ones that are explicit in the Torah. And in the next source, Maimonides explains what he means by that. And here is Sefer HaMitzvot. Maimonides wrote Sefer HaMitzvot, the enumeration of the 613 commandments, as an introduction to Mishneh Torah, his compendium of Talmudic law. And in that introduction, Maimonides says, I have to explain what is the logic of this 613 enumeration, the enumeration of the 613 commandments. And he has 14 principles at the introduction to this work. And the number 14 seems to be a number Maimonides liked. He has 14 books of Mishneh Torah. There are other works of his that seem to be following the enumeration of 14. He has 14 principles. The first principle of Sefer HaMitzvot is that 613 mitzvot were given to Moshe at Sinai, the rabbis tell us. That means that you can only count among those laws that are d'oraita. And therefore he criticizes earlier scholars such as the Baal Halachot Gedolot, who included laws that are only d'rabbanan. But how do you know what's d'oraita and what's d'rabbanan? So in the second principle he clarifies that he says that only laws that are pshuto shel mikra are d'oraita, and anything that's learned by way of drash is only d'rabbanan. Okay, now that's a very, very striking comment. And he says, but that's why, and I'm not going to read it inside because we're running out of time, but that's okay, you can look at this inside afterwards. Maimonides here is addressing a perplexity, that when Rashi talks about Ani lo bati alu pshuto shel mikra, and Ibn Ezra talks about the centrality of pshuto shel mikra, how does that translate to the Talmud? Rashi doesn't talk about it. Rashi's grandson, Rashbam, reached a pinnacle of pshat interpretation, and he will at times give interpretations of halachic passages that don't agree with the Talmud, as some of you may know. And he doesn't explain why he does that. He says, I'm going to explain pshat, because pshat is important. So how do you bridge that with what you learned in Talmud? And Rashbam was a great Talmudist. He was one of the Balei HaTosfot. Doesn't tell you. Maimonides addresses this issue. He takes the bull by the horns and he says, I'm going to make the following distinction. What is pshat is d'oraita, what is drash is d'rabbanan. Now, it is not that simple. Okay, and if I had it, sometimes I give a lecture only on this. Actually, some of the students in the audience know I give a whole course on this subject. It's a fascinating subject. It is more complex. You'll see Ramban in the next source wrote a critique of the Rambam. He says this contradicts, this demolishes the entire Talmud. You know, none of the Talmud is pshat. So what I have done in my studies, I've seen that Maimonides here is using conceptions that he borrowed, a framework, and conceptions that he borrowed from Muslim jurisprudence. Now, that is an interesting kind of approach. Some of you may find this unusual, but I'll tell you the following. When you look in Sefer HaMitzvot, and this goes back to what Dr. Berger mentioned, Dean Berger mentioned earlier about the syllabus in the yeshiva world. I'll take the comments at the end. We're reaching the end. Sefer HaMitzvot is there. It's on the shelf. But you have to be aware of something. Maimonides wrote Sefer HaMitzvot in Arabic. Some of the people in this audience are attorneys. Some even judges, I remember when I was younger, I used to give shiurim in my shul, people who did not have a Talmudic background but had a very strong legal background. It was very clear to me how they were able to analyze the Talmud, with crystal clear sharpness. Maimonides wrote a Sefer HaMitzvot in Arabic. It was translated into Hebrew. When he wrote it in Arabic, and I read the original Arabic, the terminology is legal terminology from Muslim jurisprudence. It's translated into Hebrew. The translators had to find Talmudic terminology. So you read it, you take it off of the shelf, you read it, oh, this seems like the Rambam is a Talmudist. He's not a standard Talmudist. When he talks about Pshuto Shel Mikra, there's a category in Muslim jurisprudence which, as I said, is parallel in many respects. Some scholars have shown that Muslim jurisprudence itself, much of it is influenced by the Talmud, but then the influence becomes reversed, and Jews drew upon the Muslim conceptions. In the Muslim tradition, there's a concept of the text of the Quran, and then the oral interpretation that was transmitted through the companions of the Prophet Muhammad. And then, after that, there was an expansion of the laws by way of legal analogy that they referred to as kiyas. Kiyas is similar to our word hekesh. And when the Rambam talks about midot hadrash as opposed to pshat, what he says in his introduction to his commentary on the Mishnah is when Torah shebichtav was given, it was given with a Torah shebal peh, an original oral interpretation, and that for the Rambam is all part of Pshuto Shel Mikra. So when the rabbis tell us that they have that a tradition going back to Sinai says ayin tachat ayin is not literal, that's not drash for the Rambam. That is Pshuto Shel Mikra. So what does the Rambam differentiate? He's saying the later things that are learned through the Yud Gimel Midos Hadrash, that is what is drabanan. And so it still is a little bit more complicated than that. I'm giving it to you really al ktzeh hamazleig. But what I really wanted to do here is to illustrate the expanse and the depth and breadth of Maimonides' commentaries on the Torah and how crucial they are for a full understanding of our tradition of Parshanut. Thank you very much.